Hello and welcome to Advanced Practice Weekly. My name is AJ Batt and I will be your host. Today I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Deborah Harding. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you, AJ. It's really nice to be here.
Deborah, tell us a little bit about yourself. In the advanced practice world, you're very well known for all the work you've done around clinical supervision, and a lot of my colleagues have been taught by you. But if you just give us a little bit of a background about how long you've been working within the NHS and in the world of education.
Okay, so I graduated as a speech and language therapist back in the late 80s, early 90s. And my clinical interest as a speech and language therapist was in neuro, and I worked in acute neurosurgery and in neuro rehab before moving into more management roles. So I had a spell working as a manager of a ward and inpatient service. I had a cluster of different services that I managed as an associate director in what was a mental health trust, but an interesting range of mostly physical health services that sort of found their way into that trust environment. And then in 2008, moved back into London to work in education. So I joined Kingston and St George's faculty. And there I was teaching things like quality improvement and reflective practice, and started to get interested in supervision. And that's where my PhD in supervision came from, and how I think I hit the radar of Health Education England in the advanced clinical practice context, because my supervision work was about multiple professions.
And I think for them, they were probably very happy to have you coming on board, because there were lots of questions about supervision at that time and have been since then. And you've been able to answer a lot of those questions for us through the research you've done, I think.
I think one of the challenges with supervision, and this might have come up in some of your other podcasts, but we use the word as if we all understand what it means. But there's lots of definitions out there. And I think our important starting point is checking with one another if we are doing what we both think we're doing when we're in that supervision space. And I think that's particularly true when we're working across professions, supervising and being supervised by people who don't share our registration. So yeah, I've spent the last couple of years really trying to listen hard to the advanced practice world and the challenges they're finding around supervision and what they mean by it, and finding the common ground.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. So I'm going to ask you a bit of a controversial question now. So Deborah, there is a notion that the supervision that you get whilst you're being educated is an educational type of supervision, and clinical supervision doesn't actually start until you are post-reg qualified. What do you think about that?
I suppose that depends whether you think supervision is a subset of education or is education a subset of supervision. But I suppose in the advanced clinical practice context and the advanced practice context, the challenge is you are a learner and a registered professional. So I think you are having something that is probably a hybrid. So it's partly about your learning and your education. And if clinical supervision is more about governance, then it's certainly about that as well. For me, the thing to do is to not get too tied up in knots about this, but to remind ourselves that supervision is about feeling and being professionally safe. And that in turn is important if we're going to maintain public safety. So in the advanced practice context, we've got all these really experienced practitioners, many of them a decade of experience and expertise underneath their belt, and they have a really hard won professional registration. And now they're embarking on a learning project to augment their existing knowledge and skills to that advanced level. So I don't think it's as simple as saying it's one or the other.
That's brilliant. That's exactly the answer I was looking for, because I feel in quite a similar way. And it's quite interesting, because I think we do forget that most people in advanced practice are already qualified and registered professions in their chosen field already. And this is, for want of a better word, I hate to use the word, but a top up almost of more learning, of more skills, of more knowledge, and if anything, augmenting. And it's more of a, it's gaining new skills, new knowledge, and building on what you've already got, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I've totally stolen that word augmenting because I heard Kim Manley talking and using that word. And I just thought, yes, that's exactly what we're doing. We're augmenting what we can already do to an advanced level, taking ourselves to the real kind of brink of our scope of practice, if you like. We're really maximizing our scope of practice for patient benefit. And it's keeping an eye on both those things, your professional safety, feeling professionally safe, that your registration that's hard won is going to be protected as you develop to this advanced level, but in turn making sure that patients feel safe with you and are safe with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were going to talk today a little bit about how we can use theories within our supervision. So if I'm a supervisor and I've now been given some new trainee advanced practitioners or some supervisees, whatever we want to call them, and I'm thinking of different ways of how I can use all the theory in supervision that's out there on a practical basis. And I think there's this theory practice and knowledge and skills acquisition. And so I just wanted to see if we could unpick some of that and delve a little bit deeper and hopefully look at something like Kolb cycle and how we can operationalize that Kolb cycle in an actual practical manner.
I think this is something we sometimes overlook in supervision. We often, if we go on education programs and we're developing our education knowledge and theory, our understanding of learning theories, we don't always think about bringing them into the supervision space, but I think they can be really useful because a lot of what we're doing in advanced practice is around the knowledge and skills. Skills acquisition, knowledge acquisition is right at the heart of this. Something I often do with the students and supervisees that I work with is start by asking them to think about stuff that they've got good at. And I often encourage them to think about things, not just in the work context or in the advanced practice context, but to think about things outside work and inside work. And incidentally, I don't think we do this enough with patients either. We don't often enough ask a patient, tell me how you got good at something, and work with their preferences, their strengths for learning to do something in a new way. Then I would get them to think about whether they can rank those things that they would say they were good at, and to think about the sorts of criteria that they use to decide on that ranking. So it might be how accurately they do something. So if they pick, for example, making a particular kind of cake, it might be that they're really precise and they know exactly what it's going to turn out like. So they're really confident, they've got good self-efficacy. So it starts to introduce these ideas without what sometimes is quite a lot of pressure in supervision to say, if we leap straight to the clinical, sometimes we're like, we think we're under surveillance and we're being tested. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And it's quite interesting because I think historically you would probably look at the things you weren't very good at.
Yeah.
And you'd put those at the top of the list, wouldn't you? And be like, these are the things I need to improve on.
Yeah.
But I guess by trying to focus on the areas which you are good at, whether they're in life or hobbies or anything, then you're really pulling on those people's strengths, and hopefully you can then link those strengths to their working practices. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're also then developing a little rapport with people, aren't we? So we're doing two things at the same time. But I think you're right, we too often focus on what people can't do, and I think that can put us on the back foot as a learner or as a supervisee. So I'm a big fan of building on what we can already do and how could we have more of it and how did we get to that place. So then getting people to think about the sorts of approaches as well when you do that. What sorts of things did they do that helped them to get good at it? So they often come up with things like practice, repetition, good instruction, a thoughtful teacher, an encouraging parent, all those sorts of things that seem really obvious, but actually we sometimes lose sight of in the heat of the clinical context. And thinking about a range of things, so that's the other reason I might get them to rank things and to think about different things. So if they thought about learning a new language and learning to drive and then some clinical knowledge and skills, do they think they're using similar or different approaches? So getting us to think about there's not just one way of doing it.
So I suppose by ranking the things that they're good at, you can then you can maybe then see if there are any similarities between different things that they're good at, because they rank them at the same height, and there may be some sort of connection between them. They might all be practical things, they might be all
exactly
quite academic, and then you can hopefully benchmark them across to stuff that they're trying to do academically or within advanced practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting. Okay, so that's a really good starting point. And I guess, as you touched on it, about building up that supervision relationship is cited in so many journals and so much evidence as being probably one of the most important parts of the supervision journey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it gives you then something you can relate back to, that you're, when that person is stuck, because very often at the beginning of supervision, things are early in the learning process and you expect things not to be easy straight away. But if you get an enduring issue, you've got something to link back to say, let's think back to when you told me how you got good at driving or playing golf or whatever it is. And I think this idea of what sits behind our mastery of something, what were those different components, understanding the individual learner and the supervisor, really tuning into the fact that this is multi-layered and there are lots of different things that contribute to that person feeling a sense of mastery of something. I think it's also helpful to ask people about the things that maybe they never quite mastered and perhaps gave up on, and what sorts of factors made mastery difficult and what things they might do differently if they had another go. And that's different, I would argue, to what you just said before, AJ, about us often starting with what you can't do.
Yeah, I guess, yes, it's a very different take on it, isn't it? Because you're asking them about things that they've tried that they didn't quite get. You mentioned golf. I've tried to play golf many times and I've never mastered it. And for me, it's probably one of the most frustrating games in the world. However, I have tried and I still do enjoy it, but I haven't been able to get very good at it despite trying. And I think but it's not a negative thing in my life. It's a positive thing because I have tried it.
Yeah. And it's also then about knowing your limitations, isn't it? It's like knowing when golf is the right answer and when it's not. And sometimes that's true in clinical contexts too. So I think it's, for me, this is it seems like a really sort of simple idea, but I think it can be really powerful.
When you'd have that, when you have that first supervision meeting and you're sitting there in front of somebody that you've never met before, or they've just joined your team and you have to get to know them, you might have thought of questions like this, and if you have, then amazing, you've done it, well done, good luck to you. But if you haven't thought about it, it's really nice for people to give you some examples of how to do it.
Exactly. And I would have been really grateful to have had some of these ideas in the beginning, because I think that's the other thing that's really important to share with people, is even the greatest supervisors didn't start out as the greatest supervisors. This isn't something that drops out of the sky. People work at it. Their skills and their techniques and their things that we've tried, experimented with, and some of those experiments have turned out well and we do it again the next time we do supervision with somebody, and some of them we think, oh, that wasn't so successful, we won't be doing that. So this is a really important point, I think, is to stress that becoming a good supervisor is also something you have to work at.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a massive appetite at the moment for training for supervisors. There's also a big appetite for learners to learn how supervision is conducted and how it actually works, because if you've never done it before, it might be very alien to you.
Really exposing, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think having that relationship in the beginning is really important. Feel like you've got that safe space to be able to do that. Okay, great.
Let me share one more possible tip then that I think can be quite a kind of fun way to get going with some of this knowledge and skills acquisition understanding. So it's to pick something. So I often pick making an origami flapping bird, the crane thing. And I often just give people a picture of that and some paper and say, can you make one of these? Or I might give them one that I've already made. Happens to be the only bit of origami I've ever mastered, if we're going back to the mastery idea. But again, I do that because, or I might ask, just they might not want to do it in front of me, but if I've got a group of people, it's quite a fun thing to do. And then to think about how they went about that origami task. So did they already know how to make one? Would they like to have seen someone make one first? Would they like to be shown how to do it? Would they like to take the one that I'd made and unfold it and see how it worked? Would they go to YouTube and look for a video? Did they want some diagrams to follow, perhaps? Just don't crowd my head with the video, but just give me a static set of diagrams and can I work from those? And some people just go, why are you even asking me to do this? But it, again, it's a really useful way of exploring the way that person went about maybe an unfamiliar, practical, hands-on task.
Yeah, you definitely, I think you'll find out about how different people learn, won't you, or want to learn, because some will go straight for the video, some will be, why, as you said, why am I doing this? I'm in a session about supervision.
Yeah.
And then you might get others that just want some handwritten instructions.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where we come to a bit of theory, really, because a lot of people I find are familiar through other courses they've done. A lot of healthcare professionals have heard about Kolb's learning cycle and the idea of learning preferences. And Kolb talks about how we take things in, either in a sort of concrete, get stuck in sort of a way, or are we more on a kind of continuum toward a theoretical concept, theorists sort of way of thinking about things. So there's one that's our kind of taking things in perception continuum from concrete to theoretical, and then a sort of processing continuum, which is from practical experimentation through to more reflective observer. And then you can start to take people's answers to how they got good at stuff and how they went about that origami bird activity to get a sense of where their preferences are on that Kolb cycle, which I'm sure if people Google it, they'll find that diagram with concrete and theoretical top and bottom and practical experimentation on the left and reflector observation on the right. So it gives us a sort of frame to make sense of those preferences.
So for those listeners who may not be familiar with Kolb's learning cycle, it's four sections. And at the top, we have concrete experience. On the right-hand side, we have reflective observation. At the bottom, we have theoretical concepts. And on the left-hand side, we have practical experimentation. And it is hoped that we would go round this cycle in a circle, but you can go back and forth into individual sections of it. Is that right, Deborah?
Yeah, and I think what you're highlighting there is really important, because sometimes we see like a survey or a questionnaire approach saying, asking a learner or a supervisee to rate how they or to mark their preferences. I think we need to not think about a model like this in a static way, as if we're always going about tasks the same way. Hence, when I ask people how they got good at stuff, I ask them to think about a range of things, because we might start at different places on the cycle and have different preferences for different sorts of phenomenon, different things we need to learn. So asking people how they got good at stuff, for me, is more effective than using a questionnaire or some kind of rating scale, because that sort of pigeonholes the learner, and I don't think that's very helpful. Then they tend to expect they're always going to go about learning things in the same way, and you start to expect they'll only go about learning things in a particular way.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw this cycle, the way the arrows are depicted, it infers that you would go round it in a cycle in just one way, but you can actually come into this at any point, can't you? That practical experimentation, you could just pick it up and start to play with something. It's like me with some IKEA furniture. I'm not going to read the instructions. I'm just going to unpack it and start to put things together and then work out halfway through that it's wrong. But
yeah, so you're going to start with a bit of practical experimentation. The concrete experience is not going to be all that satisfactory. So that's when you might pause and reflect and go, this doesn't look like the piece of furniture I was anticipating it would be. I better look at the instructions. So you go back to the theoretical concept.
There we go. Kolb's learning.
Kolb's learning right there. So that's a brilliant example. And of course, it's never one cycle, because it's a bit like we talk about in quality improvement being continuous cycle. We're always going, none of these things are either linear or one cycle. It's much more, as you said, back and forwards, a bit of experimentation and then a bit of theoretical reviewing. And that's where I think this idea is really helpful in the supervision context, because it helps us to think about what the options might be, rather than thinking this person will only ever master this this way.
Yeah, absolutely. When I saw this, that IKEA furniture came straight to mind to me. So it's a really nice way of visualizing it, because when you look at it, and the terminology as well can sometimes theoretical concepts, what does that mean? If you're not an academic, or you haven't seen this before, then it might just scare you off a little bit from using it. But if you can have a practical example for it, like with the origami, like with the furniture, it actually makes you think, actually, this is really easy to use in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think about the theoretical concepts bit in a clinical sense, that's often what we front load, isn't it? That's what we do first. We often attend some teaching, or we're asked to read some literature, or read a textbook, or we see someone else demonstrating the skills. So it's all very theoretical at that point. And then we might move towards some practical experimentation, but perhaps in quite a controlled way. So we might be having a go in the sim lab, or watching the supervisor do the procedure and being guided by the supervisor. And it's not until we've been to that part of the cycle, that practical experimentation, that we start doing that procedure with a variety of different patients in different circumstances. And it's that concrete experience that then is where we might start to feel a bit of uncertainty, which is an idea I know you've talked about in some of your other podcasts. But that uncertainty is then something we might take back to our supervisor, and they might encourage us to reflect on our practice or think about other sorts of learning experiences we need to cement our skills.
Amazing. There we go. Kolb's learning cycle from a clinical perspective. So, Deborah, if we want to now put this into the context of advanced practice as a learning cycle, let's take an advanced practice physio, for instance. Looking, I think one of the examples you showed me previously was a shoulder. Could you just take me through that process briefly?
Yeah. It could be a physio, it could be a paramedic, couldn't it? It could be someone working in ED, someone's come in with an injured shoulder. If we start again down at those theoretical concepts, then that practitioner might be thinking, I know the theory and research about how to assess the shoulder. I've done my clinical classes on this, and we had practical sessions where I assessed shoulders, and I'm passed my exam. So you've done that practical experimentation. But perhaps, say you didn't do that great in your sim classes, or you didn't do that great in your exam, your mark wasn't as strong as you'd hoped it was going to be. You're maybe a little bit uncertain about how that is going to land when you're clinically assessing shoulders in practice. But perhaps you see yourself as an activist sort of concrete learner. So you're thinking, actually, if I start seeing patients and assessing shoulders in real time, in a clinical setting, I'm probably going to start to feel more confident about this. But as we all know, clinical reality doesn't always play out as we anticipated. You've seen maybe 3 or 4 patients now with shoulder pain, but you're not feeling that your confidence is being restored. You're starting to feel uncertain about it. And that prompts you, that uncertainty acts as a prompt to learn, a prompt to go to your supervisor and think about how you might improve your knowledge and skills with shoulder assessment, and also how you might develop your confidence with this aspect of practice. So you take it to your supervisor, and your supervisor then explores with you some of the options for how you might improve your confidence and your knowledge and skills. And they could be in any of those different domains of Kolb's learning styles, learning preferences, and different parts of the cycle. So they might say, you know what, let's go and assess a patient together. Let me come and see how you're doing that. That would be a kind of concrete experience opportunity, but we'll do it together. We'll get some reflection going on because I will be there with you as a supervisor, and you can talk me through what you're doing. It might be that the supervisor is more concerned about the practitioner's uncertainty. Maybe they're really picking up a lot of concern from the trainee. So they might think, let's get this person to watch me do some assessments of shoulders and get them to reflect on what they see me doing. So a more reflective approach to resolving the concern. It might be that in questioning, the supervisor picks up that there are some gaps in that supervisee's knowledge, and they prompt them to go back to the textbook, go and review some of their lecture notes, maybe attend some in-service training sessions that you know are upcoming, perhaps link them up with some other trainees and get them to assess one another's shoulders and get used to handling in a less kind of intense clinical context. So that's thinking about different ways, different approaches to learning that might help to unblock this concern and build the trainees' confidence.
Some really nice practical examples there, aren't there, of how we can overcome some of those issues that that trainee's having. There are lots of other things that potentially we could ask them to go and work with a peer for the day, or go to a shoulder clinic, or there's lots of different things, aren't there? But I think the key point is here is that the supervisor has realized, or the supervisee has realized there's an issue. They've taken it to the supervisor, and the supervisor has all these different things in the arsenal to be able to help try and resolve them in different ways.
Yeah, and I think there I'd say it's really important that both supervisor and supervisee are engaged in this resolving the practice concern together. It's not that the supervisor's necessarily going to have some kind of magic. The supervisee needs to take responsibility for their own practice as well. And not least, as we said before, because they are a registered practitioner who is responsible for their own knowledge and skills and maintaining those at an appropriate level within their scope of practice. So it's absolutely a collaboration. But yeah, it gives us options and not thinking about always going about things in the same way. So the supervisor might have a preferred way of doing things that doesn't make sense to the supervisee. And supervision is not about creating a mini version of the supervisor. It's about helping that supervisee, that learner, that practitioner to overcome their own uncertainties and to build their own knowledge and skills and confidence at an advanced level.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, isn't it? That as the supervisor, we have to think about the ways that are going to help the student or the supervisee. Not the easiest route for yourself as the supervisor, right? Is the other issue as well. In busy departments and within the NHS and today, it's extremely, there's a lot of pressure, isn't there? So we still have to have that two-way conversation.
Can I just add one more thing there as well, which is about, so again, coming back to the Kolb idea, I think as a supervisor, one of the tough things can be to encourage that learner, that trainee, that supervisee to depart from their preferred ways of learning, because we get quite stuck in ways that are familiar to us. So if you think about Kolb, if your supervisee is insisting on just carrying on seeing more patients, if in supervision they think their answer to getting more confident with the shoulder is to, if I just keep seeing shoulder patients, if you just make sure that I get access to the patients who come in with a shoulder pain, I'm going to get better at this. And as a supervisor, you might be saying, maybe I can see that concrete experience is what you prefer doing, but maybe you need to go back to your notes and do a bit more theoretical exploration. Or as you suggested, AJ, maybe you need to go and shadow a colleague or spend the afternoon in the shoulder clinic. Perhaps it'd be useful to spend some time in with our colleagues down in imaging and look at some images of shoulders and understand some of the underlying anatomy a bit more. So it can be sometimes about nudging that person to adopt a less go-to approach to conquer the challenges that they're encountering.
Yeah, I think we definitely will all try and avoid the things we don't like doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so thank you very much, Deborah Harding, for joining us today and taking us through Kolb's cycle and giving us some really practical examples of how we can use this within the clinical environment and specifically around clinical supervision. I specifically want to just recap on the setting up that supervision relationship and asking your supervisees about things that they have done well in their life and also maybe things that they have done but haven't quite conquered or become masters of, because that's a really nice and interesting way to look at how people start to learn. Thank you so much for the practical examples of using Kolb's cycle. It's been really interesting, and thanks for coming on the programme.
It's been great to join you. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on Advanced Practice Weekly. Join us next week for more advanced practice topics, and we'll see you soon. Take care, everybody. Thank you.